Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. We've been hearing a lot about healthcare recently. Certainly this station has been airing a lot of information, forums that have been taking place on the issue of the cost of healthcare in Alaska. It's said to be the highest in the country, and of course, United States healthcare is the most expensive in the world, and that's higher than it's ever been. So we may have the most expensive healthcare that's ever existed on the planet. Alaska's always number one. But we might not want to be number one in this one. And so today's topic is to find solutions for the healthcare cost crisis in Alaska and give you a chance to talk back to the radio. On Addressing Alaskans, you've heard a series of forums from Alaska Common Ground, which have been touching on healthcare. There was one broadcast yesterday. And this is a chance to have some of the experts in the studio bring up your own ideas and ask your own questions. And the man who has been organizing those really interesting Alaska Common Ground forums is here, Cliff Groh. He's the chair of Alaska Common Ground. Thanks for being here, Cliff.
Thanks, Charles. Feel lucky to be here.
Well, that's good to hear. And Thea Agnew-Bemben is here. She's with Agnew-Beck Consultants, and she's going to be appearing on a panel tonight for another Alaska Common Ground forum at the 49th State Brewery at 6 p.m. Thanks for being here, Thea.
Thank you for inviting me.
And listeners who are very attentive listeners to our station will know that I was on one of these former panels and was heard on that recording, and I've also written some columns on the subject that are opinionated. My goal today is going to be not that. My goal is going to be as moderator. So I'm going to try very hard to just be disinterested and not express opinions. If you think that I'm not fulfilling that job, please call in and let me know. It's easy to get on the air with us today. The number is 550-8433, 550-8433. And if you're outside of Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometownofalaskapublic.org. Thea, you're a small business person. You have a consulting firm with employees. It's been around for a while. It's obviously a successful business. How much is healthcare a factor for you in running your business? Is it something you have to think about? Is it something that makes it difficult to start businesses or to run businesses?
Well, we've been in business now for 15 years, and this is actually our 16th year, and we now have 23 employees. So for a while we were, you know, kind of under 10. And then I'd say once we got to around maybe six or seven people, we decided, okay, really, to recruit people and retain them, you have to provide health insurance. So we started into that road. When we first started, we were interested in kind of teaming up with another small business, and soon learned that that's totally not allowed. Everyone gets evaluated separately unless you're owned by the same corporation. And so every time you go to purchase your policy, you really kind of wander into this world of brokers and different plan choices and different prices. There's a lot of complexity to it. So we kind of make our best choice. As we went forward, you know, we now have 23 employees. The makeup changes. And over that period of time, we really, at the beginning, saw these huge increases in price. And we're suddenly like, whoa, can we really not afford to do this? Once the Affordable Care Act was passed, for us, it really helped us because our employees tend to be younger. And just with all the changes in the market, our premiums became more stable. But I would say it's a huge factor in running a small business. It's definitely the second highest thing we pay for every year, aside from our payroll.
So big, more than rent, more,
oh,
more
absolutely.
Than equipment.
Yeah, way yeah. more. Yeah, no, it's very expensive. And it's certainly, you know, as your employees stay with you and have families and get older, the costs go up because that's how it works. And I think for anybody who is contemplating either being self-employed, I mean, I was self-employed for 6 years before starting a company. And at that time, I just had catastrophic insurance. But for anybody who's self-employed, especially if you're older, it can be incredibly expensive to be paying your individual self. So I think that what that does is, for people who are entrepreneurs, it really limits their ability to switch from being employed, especially with a large employer which might have good health care, to being self-employed. Because suddenly for yourself, you're going to have to pay these high premiums. And then if you take on employees, you're going to be wandering into that market.
Yeah.
So it's a huge dampening on our entrepreneurial effort here in the state.
Holding down our economic growth and development.
Yeah.
Let me turn to Cliff Groh, who sounds like he needs health care right now. He's coughing and he has a lozenge. Hopefully, we're not all going to need health care by the time we're done. Cliff, you've studied this issue quite a bit. You put on these forums. What's your sense of the impact of the healthcare cost in Alaska on our economy and on our jobs and on the ability to run businesses?
Healthcare in Alaska is a drag on the economy. Alaska Common Ground, in one of the four previous events it had, but in the series before tonight, had a whole program on the consequences, human, economic, and fiscal. Of high healthcare costs in Alaska, and business people talked about how difficult it was to make it work here. And I've heard, like you have, I know from reading your columns, Charles, stories from other people who have not started businesses, who have not expanded businesses, who've actually left the state to get, they wanted to stay in Alaska, but they felt they couldn't stay in Alaska because of the high healthcare costs here, and are actually refugees, healthcare refugees from the 49th state. And so there's both a blighting and holding back of human potential here because of the high healthcare costs, which are thousands of dollars per person higher than any other state in the country, according to federal data. And of course, it's hard to measure, but it appears that that fairly measured healthcare costs represent about a third of the budget, the state of Alaska's budget, which
incredible.
Is obviously and a very fast growing part of it over the years. And one of the major elements of the state's substantial fiscal challenge going forward.
Do you feel like in your previous forums you've gotten, at least to your satisfaction, a finger on what's causing or what the main where the money is going that's different from other places? In other words, are insurance companies making more money? Are drug companies making more money? Are doctors or hospitals? Or where are we out of line compared to other places?
Well, the federal data, looking at every state by various categories of expenditures, shows that the difference in Alaska, why we're higher than the national average, is almost entirely composed of two categories, which they call physician and clinical services in one category, and hospital care in the other, and. There, in terms of where the money is going, it's clear that hospital stays cost more here than they do in other states, and also that, particularly for some subspecialists in Alaska, like orthopedic surgeons, neurosurgeons, and cardiac specialists, there is a very substantial premium of working in Alaska compared to other states.
So more money is being spent on the actual care. It's not just the insurance companies are charging too much.
It appears to be mostly an issue. And, you know, there may be a health insurance element too, but a lot of it is the higher healthcare prices in Alaska. And as you helped point out in various forums or places, it's not so much the utilization is high in Alaska. There's a problem of utilization. People maybe
we don't go to the doctor too frequently.
Right, right. Yeah. There's maybe more utilization. You know, utilization issues and ways to fix or reduce it some around in various ways. And we've talked about that on the stage, Alaska healthcare events, Alaska Common Ground events. But the bigger issue here in Alaska appears to be the prices. The prices are just higher here for healthcare, substantially higher.
All right. Well, that's it. That's summary of our topic today on Hometown Alaska. So we welcome your calls. Everyone is facing this healthcare cost problem in our personal lives and in our businesses and even in our government expenses. So if you have questions or comments, if you have solutions you'd like us to talk about, you can get on the air with us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, the number is 888-353-5752. And the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. And the event we're talking about is happening tonight at 6 p.m. at the 49th State Brewery. My guests are Cliff Groh, you just heard from, Chair of Alaska Common Ground, and Thea Agnew-Bemben of Agnew Beck Consultants. So let's jump to the biggest kind of total solution, and the solution that's used in other countries. Other developed countries mostly have some kind of single-payer or nationalized healthcare system. where you don't pay for it at all. You just go to the doctor when you're sick, and the government pays for it, and so then it comes out of your taxes in some way. And there's various ways to do that. It's obviously a solution that is out there. It's being talked about at the federal level. A bunch of candidates who are thinking about running for president have brought up the single-payer solution. Let's just throw that around a little bit, what the benefits of it are and the practicalities of it are. Is single-payer something that makes sense for us to look at here in Alaska? Cliff, do you want to take that one first?
Sure.
I'd love to hear Thea's thoughts on it.
Sure. Single-payer is seen by its supporters to have at least two advantages. One of which is that it would substantially reduce or maybe eliminate the role of private health insurance, and there is a cut for private health insurance in terms of the companies, in terms of their cut from this very large and expensive healthcare system we have in the United States and very much so in Alaska. Additionally, supporters of single-payer healthcare also hope and contend that if you still had your providers like the doctors and hospitals remaining in the private sector, the single-payer system would create a larger pool and have more bargaining power to help lower or at least contain the prices that are charged by those medical providers.
Well,
it seems like
if there's only one payer, then it could essentially dictate the prices, right? I mean, you would take that price or you leave.
That would be a harsher way of saying
yeah,
it, Charles.
But I mean,
yeah. So those are the advantages that are pushed by mm-hmm. promoters of single payer. Now, there are other questions people raise, which is one you've alluded to, which is single payer viable in our country if it's done by a single state? Some other states have tried and have not been able to pull off a full system. And Alaska is obviously one of the states with the smallest populations in the United States and obviously has some other issues with that. Would it be feasible for the state of Alaska to do it by itself? A number of the people wonder how single payer would be financed. And you suggested the way it's financed is through taxes. Do people want to pay higher taxes? Do they think they would get the value of that?
But it's a reallocation of who's paying, right? Because now someone like Thea is paying out of directly for her salaried employees. She would presumably be paying a tax. Would it be the same, more or less? What do you think about the idea of single payer, Thea? Do you think it's a practical thing for us to be considering?
I guess I would want to start to answer that question by pointing out one of the key things that is lacking here in our current system that needs to be in place, and that is some incentive on the part of the payer to improve the person whose care they're paying for, to improve their health. So right now what we have is a very unmanaged system. Unless you're talking about our tribal health system, our system in Alaska is entirely unmanaged. We don't have coordination. We don't have managed care. So it's a fee-for-service system where you get paid for the service that you provide. And there's nobody who has a kind of overriding interest in making sure that the individual is consuming lower cost and higher value services, or just that their health is being maintained so that they don't need higher cost services. So mm-hmm. that's what's missing today. And I guess I would add to what Cliff said earlier about why are our costs so high. To me, it may be true that our prices are high. There may be a number of reasons for that. But to me, the thing that is not in place here is any downward pressure on those prices by a responsible payer. So I guess if you take that idea to its kind of logical conclusion, yeah, single payer gives you that at its highest level. I would say for us here, since we don't have anything yet, we should perhaps take a smaller step.
Right.
And that would be to do some other ways of bringing a bigger pool of Alaskans together to have a common interest.
Right. Well, I mean, you've kind of alluded to the idea of managed care, which is essentially outlawed under Alaska state law. And I mean, the law says that if you have a managed care system and your patient wants to go to another doctor, they always can. You can't force them to stay in their managed care system, which essentially, at least experts I've talked to have said, that means you really can't do it because they would just splurt out everywhere. The idea, for those who don't know, of managed care is you sell a product which is, we're going to take care of your health, you pay us this much money, we'll hire the doctors, we'll buy the hospitals, we'll do it all ourselves. And that's sort of more like the model that you're referring to, I think, Thea, where You're not buying one service at a time. You're not sort of sending people out with money to buy services they think they need. Sort of like an entity is deciding what services you need and is providing it within a context of a total fee.
Well, I guess there just are so many. I think when we use mm-hmm. the word managed care, it means like a billion things. Mm-hmm. And so everybody thinks it means something different. I guess what I'm talking about is any kind of structure within our system where there's a incentive built into the way a provider or a group of providers is paid that incentivizes them to both coordinate care and to improve health and to make sure utilization is appropriate.
Right. Which could also be called like value-based pricing, which is being done a lot in the lower 48.
Yeah, and payment
which
reform.
Which I guess I would think like more like Kaiser.
Care coordination,
Or, you know, an HMO is more as managed care, sort of this total thing.
And they use all of those tools to do that.
Let's take a call from Caroline now, who wants to share an idea with us. Caroline?
Yes, hi. One of the things I always like to know is how we got here. and a couple of things I remember from history. I heard that Truman, after World War II, he tried to get some system like is in most of Europe. The AMA apparently fought him to a draw, and he said, well, if we can't get it here, we can at least facilitate for Japan and Germany. So they helped set up their process, and it was individualized to each country. But I think those countries went ahead and set up what is equated in other countries. And then the other thing was Reagan, during his time, he was upset because the percentage, 10% was spent on paperwork, pushing paper. And at that time, I believe the HMOs came in, and it's over 30% was what I heard one time. So those two things, and also looking to see how others have done it, because as the lady just said, it's not going to be able to replicate immediately. But I remember when I, shortly after getting off the plane in Fairbanks in 1967, some weeks later asked for the name of the best doctor in Fairbanks and was told Virginia Mason.
Well, I mean, that brings up something I think is really worthwhile for us to talk about. All your points are worthwhile, Caroline, but one that I want to throw to my panel is, this was raised in one of the previous sessions that was held by Alaska Common Ground, is to what extent are we willing to pay for a completely standalone healthcare system is one of our decisions. Like, sometimes you might have to go outside if you need a specialist. And we sort of moved in the direction of the fee-based system we have now of importing a lot of things here, which may not be used efficiently because there's not that much need for them. Clef, have you thought about that?
Yeah, and I want to quote an economist here in Alaska, Jonathan King, who was kind enough to spend some time explaining things to me. And he said, Clef, the way to think about some of the more fancy buildings we have in the medical complex here in Anchorage, like Tower T at Providence or the Orthopedic Physicians Alaska building on Lake Otis Boulevard, is that they're sort of like our version of an NFL stadium, except we never got to vote on the higher taxes to finance them. That we have a more lavish infrastructure than we can really afford. And that is one of the major problems Alaska has. In the 60s, as your caller was saying, people suggested, if you want to go see a great doctor, go to Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle. And
or if you have some illness, which is not covered by our range of specialists here.
And now,
which is still the truth to some extent.
Right. But now we've, since the 60s, had a very much of an influx of some higher educated and, in many cases, or all cases, higher priced subspecialist physicians that have been associated with higher costs here in Alaska. And I think Thea?
I guess I just want to point out that argument makes it seem as if we improved our healthcare system that we would lose specialists. The system we have in Anchorage right now, and I'm not going to speak to the whole state with this particular statement because our state is made up of many small markets which operate quite differently. So Fairbanks, for example, is quite different from how Anchorage operates. But Anchorage right now, the types of healthcare that are hardest to come by are primary care, behavioral health, preventive care. Those are the things that are actually in shortest supply and are hardest to coordinate. And what is probably easiest to get is an appointment with a cardiologist or an orthopedic surgeon. So when we talk about what I think the caller's kind of intimating, some type of rationing, you know, that certain services wouldn't be available, the kind of free sort of wheeling approach that we have right now is actually making the things that we all need the least available. And I think that's mm-hmm. not the type of rationing that any rational system would make happen.
But it's partly, I think, and I want to hear my expert speak about this, but in the primary care, there is competition. So the insurance companies have some ability to drive down prices, because if a primary care practice won't go into a network, they can find another one. But with certain specialties, there's only one game in town. So there's really no ability for the insurance companies to do that competition of who's in network and who's not. True, Cliff?
Right. There is a lesser competition in some specialties, but a large supply of some people working at some of those specialty clinics. I would also note that, looking back on the series of the with after tonight will be five events in our series on Alaska's high healthcare costs, we've sort of identified two of the possible smaller solutions, or let's call it less sweeping solutions, that would have been helpful. One is that Alaska, as Thea pointed out, has a relative shortage of mental health and behavioral specialists, and that mental health and behavioral problems are often a big factor in Alaska's high healthcare costs in a variety of ways and mechanisms and pathways. Additionally, another potential solution, Alaska, or change that would be helpful is if we could somehow have some sort of compensation imbalance. We have a gross imbalance in our country, but particularly in our state, of what some certain subspecialists get paid. Sometimes I've met a neurosurgeon who made more than $5 million net income in Alaska, more than tripled
annually.
Yeah, more than tripled his income by moving from mm-hmm. Washington State to Alaska. On the other hand, there's some primary care providers here in Anchorage who have clearly been struggling.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to a question from the internet, which is going to take us in the direction of one of the topics on tonight's forum. Tom asks, why would eliminating the 80% payment rule for non-network providers reduce costs in a small market with little competition? Wouldn't the insurance companies just happily pass along the increased costs, and with little competition, the non-network providers would just keep charging them? I think just to explain the rule, and even this is greatly simplifying it, but the idea is that The 80% rule is for if you go to a doctor who is not within your network, in other words, not covered by insurance normally at a lower level. Under this state regulation, the insurance company is required to pay 80% of the usual and customary charge for that code that they would pay in general in the community. And the way this works with specialists, where there's very few competing specialists, is because that they are so large, they essentially set the usual and customary charge, and so they can pretty much be sure that they'll get 80% of it. And so I think that maybe is responding to Tom's comment, but right. Let's talk more about it. Cliff Groh, who's with Alaska Common Ground, and my other guest is Thea Agnew-Bedman.
Tom is pointing out, I think, is in part that there's more than two sides, not only on an issue, but sort of in the conflict. People often think of, well, there's usually only two sides in an issue. With healthcare, you often see conflicts between the interests of patients, the interests of providers, such as doctors and hospitals, and the interests of payers, such as insurance companies and other people like Thea, who is a small business owner, writes checks to pay for health insurance costs of other employees. So that's the 80th percentile rule helps bring out that three-way conflict in pretty sharp relief. And I will also say that, well, since, you know, we have less than an hour here in this radio show, it's useful to note that tonight from 6 to 9 p.m. we'll have a healthy debate on the 80th percentile rule.
You're going to have a whole
rule.
Segment on it, yeah.
Right, as well as on the single-payer health care and the possible creation of an Alaska health care authority.
Yeah. Thea, have you thought about this rule?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just like all three of these proposals. They are really complex. I think the first thing to realize about the 80th percentile rule is why it was put into effect. So originally it was there to protect the consumer so that the insurance company would be required to pay up to that 80th percentile And because we don't have any protection against balanced billing in Alaska, the idea was it would reduce the amount that would be passed on to the patient. Mm-hmm. So I think that's first piece. The second piece is that, you know, as I think Charles mentioned it, we were just describing this, in some areas where a specialist has the kind of control of that market, yes, they're setting the price. And I would say that's an abuse of this rule. However, I think you look at other parts of the healthcare system, like primary care, or especially the emergency department, I would say, I would just challenge us to see if this rule is being abused there as well, or is it actually doing what it's meant to do, which is protect the consumer? So to me, it's a kind of interesting issue, but I think the bigger question is, where do we ever get enough of a group together so that we can actually transform our system? And that really requires a kind of collaboration between providers, payers, and patients. And until we all decide that we're finally ready to do that, I don't know that kind of tinkering around the edges is really going to solve the problem.
I think it's an interesting topic, just pulling back to a bigger picture, though, because this is a rule that existed around the country, and it's been gotten rid of elsewhere, and it's very rare, or we're the only state that still has it. Similarly, value-based pricing, which we were discussing earlier, exists all over the country, but not in Alaska. Mm-hmm. Health HMOs exist all over the country, but not in Alaska. And so in a sense, it seems like we're struggling with issues that the rest of the country kind of struggled with 20 years ago. Why don't we do some of the things that they're doing, right? Because their healthcare costs are lower. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely think that. I mean, I think that's why sometimes I feel like these conversations get kind of repetitive, because, I mean, what I do as a consultant is work on health and human services planning and policy. And, for example, you know, the big study that we helped with for the Medicaid program when it was thinking about how to redesign, you know, it really identifies the kind of key things that you need to do to improve your system. You need to increase the use of primary care. You need to do more coordination. You need to make behavioral health services available. You need common data sharing and information sharing amongst providers. You need better transparency. You need payment reform. I mean, I think the things are kind of clear to us what we need to do, but the key sort of barrier to getting there is we don't have one kind of group that's able to kind of put the incentives in place to change the behavior in our system.
Yeah, and let's get into that a little bit later, but I want to first take a call from Dimitri, who's calling from Anchorage. Dimitri?
Yeah, hi guys, how are you?
Very good.
Hey Cliff, hi Charles. So yeah, my question was, when we keep talking about small solutions, and we've been talking about small solutions to a healthcare crisis for over 50 years now, aren't we just perpetuating the problem? Keep on saying there's some kind of small solution somewhere. And we keep on having people dying and people going bankrupt. And now our state is about to go bankrupt. And we keep on talking about small solutions. When do we stop talking about small solutions?
So you'd rather be talking about what?
I mean, like big solutions, like Medicare for all.
Medicare for all, like the single payer concept, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or Alaska Native mm-hmm. Healthcare Center, South Central Foundation, NUCA system, something mm-hmm. that works in Alaska and works for over 100,000 Alaska Native people.
Right.
When do we actually go to a tutor and diploma to drive and look at healthcare that works, where people don't have to pay, where they just walk in and get healthcare and that delivers the best results? When do we stop talking about these silly little ideas?
All right. Good point, Dimitri. Let me throw that to our panel. Thea?
I think, Dimitri, you bring up a really good point, which actually kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of managed care. I mean, I always like to say we have a really great example of care management in Alaska, and that's in our tribal health organizations. And I think South Central Foundation, which Dimitri just pointed to, is a wonderful example. And again, the key there is that healthcare system has responsibility for each of their individuals that they're covering. You know, they would call them their customer owners. that for each of them from, you know, when they're in the womb to when they're in the tomb. And because they know that they have that responsibility, they are going to build in the things that actually are the cheapest and the most effective for improving people's health, which is really good
public
prenatal
health.
Care, yep. Really good early child care, really good access to primary care, integrating behavioral health. You know, all of those things is the things that the NUCA model makes happen and the tribal health organizations do. And so I think, you know, there are some great examples there. I think people would say, well, they have a totally different financing model, which is kind of true, but it's not as true as you might think. I mean, a tribal health organization receives what I like to think of as kind of floor funding from Indian Health Service. And really what that ends up doing is paying for people who don't have another payer source. So plenty of tribal members have employer health covered health insurance. They're Medicare eligible. They're Medicaid eligible. They're, you know, they have VA benefits. And so that health organization is going to bill those payers like anybody else would, but then they have this floor funding that helps cover some of that uncompensated care that all of our health systems have. And in the meantime, they're kind of given the responsibility to use that
but
money.
But overall, it's about taking responsibility from that person and not charging them an individual fee, from the point of view of the NUCA system or South Central, they're responsible for the human being, rather.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cliff, you wanted to add before we go to break?
And the planning committee at last Common Ground that put these events together decided on January 10th, earlier this month, to have an event called Improvements, which did focus both on coordinated care, but also on the workings at the Alaska Alaska Native Medical Center. But in addition, obviously tonight, we have an event called Overhauls, which is about some bigger changes like Dimitri is suggesting, like single-payer health care. I think there'll be some discussion of it's related to cousin universal health care, as well as the creation of an Alaska Healthcare Authority, which I understand that you'll be talking more about in the second half.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we return, we'll be back with my guests, Thea Agnew-Benben from Agnew-Beck Consultants and Cliff Groh from Alaska Common Ground, and with your questions about solutions to the Alaska healthcare crisis. My name is Charles Walforth. It's Hometown Alaska. Please stay with us.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Hometown Alaska. Just a minute, I'm going to give you those phone numbers so that you can get on the air with us to talk about the cost of health care in Alaska, which is our topic today and the topic for the program this evening at the 49th State Brewery. Alaska Common Ground's Solutions Forum begins at 6 p.m., $10 suggested donation. And in the studio, we have two people who are going to be there tonight. Cliff Groh is the chair of Alaska Common Ground. He's the person who's organized these forums, which you've heard broadcast here on Alaska Public Media. Thea Agnew-Benben will be there talking as well. She's a consultant with Agnew-Beck Consultants. And one of my purposes today was to hear from you listeners. We've been bombarding you with information about this healthcare cost issue. What are your thoughts? What are the solutions you'd like to see? How urgent is it? And what would you be willing to give up in order to deal with this cost crisis? The number here to get on with us is 550-8433, 550-8433. If you're outside Anchorage, there's a toll-free number, 888-353-5752, and the email address is hometown@alaskapublic.org. So to my guests, one of the solutions which has been put on the table by Governor Walker in the legislature is to form a healthcare authority. And the essential idea behind this is to take as many of the government-funded individuals healthcare policies and put them under one organization that could then perhaps bargain for lower prices. And some have said, well, maybe we could even broaden that out to others and allow them to buy into it. And by having this large entity, maybe they'd be able to bargain for prices that are lower than the state is able to get even now with its large amount of lives covered. Thea, what do you think about this healthcare authority concept? Are there enough details really on the table to evaluate whether it makes sense or not?
Well, I think, you know, the state has done a study, which really was kind of three studies, as was mandated by SB 74, to look into this. And I think one of the things that you can, you know, learn when you read those studies is that while many states have done something called a healthcare authority, they all look fairly different. And there isn't sort of one model that we're really kind of evaluating and saying, would this work here in Alaska? There are some kind of essential elements to it, which is it's forming some type of umbrella organization, which can do things like, you know, consolidate plan management, pool purchasing, and maybe be able to, you know, do more kind of radical things like, you know, set prices, do different types of value-based plan design, all in order to kind of save money, save on the cost of doing those things as separate units. So that was what was kind of evaluated here in Alaska. So are there enough details? I don't think so. And I guess what I've been thinking about in terms of what these studies tell us is that really I think it just kind of puts the question back to us, which is, you know, we right now have a situation, as I think Cliff mentioned earlier, where the state is spending about $2 billion a year to pay for healthcare coverage for its employees, retirees, employees of other political subdivisions, and their dependents. So, plus Medicaid. And so amongst that, that's about 340,000 people. But we're doing that with over 100 different plans. So we've taken this big group and we've cut it up into a lot of tiny pieces that all kind of negotiate somewhat separately. Some of them are already pooled together. So I think, is there enough detail? I don't think that there is. I think what's on the table to us is there enough incentive amongst all those different groups that would be covered by an authority? Is there enough reason for them to want to come together and explore what could work? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if we're at that tipping point or not yet, because some of those folks are doing great. I mean, if you're a public employee, for the employee, it's awesome. You have low deductible. Some people don't pay premiums. It's a very good deal compared to like what like my employees get, for mm-hmm. example. So,
Cliff, there doesn't seem to be a ton of enthusiasm among legislators for the healthcare authority, even though it's really the only solution the state is really invested in studying. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is because the studies didn't show huge savings. Do you see, is there something missing here that people are not thinking about that could cause this to be a solution that would from some other step or something that we haven't really grasped that would make it better?
I think there may be two or three things going on simultaneously, Charles. One is the easier savings to talk about are the administrative savings, but the bigger savings are the more politically charged savings of the negotiations with the providers. The providers, you know, obviously not so thrilled by that concept. Mm-hmm. There's sort of a difficulty for some legislators to think about this. This is such a big problem that some don't want to think about it and maybe sort of hope it will go away. That same kind of successful approach that we've had some legislators have taken toward our fiscal challenge right. as a whole. I also think that people need to learn more about it. There needs to be more of an educational process. One of the reasons we're having this event from 6 to 9 p.m. at the 49 State Brewing Company tonight.
It'll be on your agenda. Yeah. Right. Let's go to Wendy, who's calling from Anchorage. Wendy?
Hi. First of all, thanks to you and Alaska Common Ground for tackling a very difficult problem. It's been really an education. My question is about concierge medicine. I am a Medicare recipient and faced with the prospect of paying a flat fee to gain access to a physician. And I'd like the panel's comments, if they have any, on the pros and cons of that. And also wonder if other countries that have single payers have concierge medicine going on the side. Thank you. I can take my, I can just listen in and get the response.
Sure. And just to make sure the listeners know, this is a kind of a high-end product where a doctor will sell a membership, and you pay an annual fee, and you get no care for that, but you get access. You get guaranteed access. You can use that doctor, which may mean you can get a quicker appointment, or you can find a doctor when you need one. And it's often or maybe always not covered by insurance. So it's something for those who have the money to pay for that. And in some cases, for very wealthy individuals, it might just be how they get their health care. Comments on that from our panel? Cliff? Go ahead, Cliff.
Concierge medicine is an example, sort of a more pure example, of tiered pricing, which is a big feature of health care in our country and in our state. Universal health care, of which single payer is one variant, has an idea of essentially more single pricing. If you go, whether you break your leg or you have a cut on your face, you can pay wildly different prices to hospitals and doctors, depending what kind of insurance plan you're in or what kind of health coverage you have in the United States and, of course, in Alaska. In France or Japan, that wouldn't be true, and a variety of other countries around the world.
But I think the question she's asking is, in other countries that have national health care, can you buy your way around it? In other words, if you want better care.
In some places you can. It's easier to do than others. In some countries, I think Thea has a point about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just going to say, I guess, two things. One is, Wendy, if I understood what you were saying correctly, this is because you're a Medicare recipient. And if you live in Anchorage, it is very difficult to access a provider if you're on Medicare, because we have such a huge gap between what Medicaid and Medicare pay on the low end and what private plans pay on the high end, that providers usually will only accept a small portion of their patient panel, if they accept them at all, with Medicaid and Medicare. Because, you know, oftentimes I'll hear them say, we can't afford to take more of those, and we have to cost shift from our private payers because that's how our cost model works. So I think what you're saying is, because you can't find good access, you're then kind of resorting to a concierge plan. And I guess I would just say, you know, sure, probably, I mean, for sure in the British system, the National Health Service is available to everybody, but it might come with a wait, or you might not be able to get the thing that you want right when you want it. And so, yes, certainly people then go and pay privately, and if they want it more quickly or they want it done by a specific person. And I guess I see that as fine. I mean, what's wrong with that? That you have a public system that provides adequate care for everybody, you know, at an affordable cost. And then if people want to upgrade and they can afford to do that, you know, that's how it goes, right? So I don't think anyone's saying, I don't think any of these proposals are like, let's be, you know, a communist country about it. You know what I mean? Like, it still happens within a capitalist economy.
Right, right.
In all sorts of countries.
Let's go to Kate, who has a personal experience she wants to share. Kate?
Hi, yeah, I just want to say I'm in favor of single payer. And I came in late, so I'm not sure I got all the info about this 80% and then healthcare authority. But I've had both hips replaced. One was done in Anchorage, one was done in Portland. Same hardware, pretty much the same procedure, and the price difference was $39,000 versus $78,000. It doesn't cost $40,000 to ship up a few pieces of metal. And I just think it's insanity, and I can't believe legislatures, insurers are tolerating this. It just seems insanity to me. So I'd like your feedback on that.
Yeah, and I think that in the previous forums and certainly in my reporting, a lot of examples of extraordinarily higher fees for procedures of that kind of large dollar procedures that have motivated insurance companies to start sending people outside and paying for their travel and paying for all kinds of stuff to go along with it. Cliff, have you? That's what you found as well, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Big differences,
right? Big differences, and also both big differences between what you'd pay in Seattle or Portland versus what you'd pay in Anchorage, but also big differences of what you'd pay in Anchorage based on what, as I said before, what insurance plan or health coverage you had. And often, Charles, as you have written, it's the people who have the least ability to pay who are often facing the highest prices.
Most, yeah. But it's also true that I don't think anybody's thoroughly unpacked where that extra, in her case, $40,000 is going. We know it's going to a higher fee, and we know it's not, as she says, it's not going to the equipment manufacturer, but how much of it is going to the physician? How much is going to the partner in that clinic? How much is going to the person who owns the surgery center? How much is going to the anesthesiologist? How much is going to the nurse?
And to the insurance company. I mean, I think...
And the hospital.
But we're talking, she's talking about what the fee is for the service. She said it was...
And the hospital.
I was just going to add one thing, and that they both were Providence. So I worked for Providence, so it was covered by Providence Insurance, and it was a Providence facility down in Portland.
Yeah.
So that's just kind of messed up.
So, I mean, has enough research been done to tease all this apart?
Hospital CEOs, and I've interviewed a couple of them, will tell you, well, Cliff, hey, construction costs are higher in Alaska, right?
But we know that that's not,
give you another a number of reasons that don't seem to add up to explain the kind of differential that the caller is talking about and that you and I have both brought out in various public events.
All right. It's Hometown Alaska, and we are talking about healthcare cost, and welcome your calls in the final 15 minutes of the show. The number here is 550-8433, 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. The email is hometown@alaskapublic.org. We've been talking a lot about healthcare cost on Alaska Public Media, and this is an opportunity for you to get your oar in. We've got two experts in the studio. Thea Agnew-Benben is a consultant with Agnew-Beck, and Cliff Groh is the chair of Alaska Common Ground. He's put together the forum, which is taking place tonight at 6 p.m. at 49th State Brewery. My name is Charles Wolforth. Now I'd like to go to Rick, who's calling from Anchorage. Rick?
Hi, and thank you for taking the time to listen to me. I am an observer of some of the healthcare travel costs in Alaska. I drive a cab in Anchorage, and I'd have to say that... I mean, I pick up people all day long that use Medicaid vouchers who come in from the rural areas. Medicaid pays for the airfare. They pay for the hotel. There's a food per diem. They pay for the taxis. And many people have escorts that come in from the rural areas. So I'd be curious to know what percentage of our healthcare costs in Alaska, Medicaid costs exactly, is the travel expense. It seems like that would be the largest line item.
I think that's a good point. Travel expenses, medevac expenses for aircraft and helicopters. And also, you know, if the same patient stayed in some village or some small community, the cost of providing care to a very small population. Do either of my guests have a comment on that, Thea?
Well, I think, I mean, what you're referring to is called non-emergency medical travel, and it's a required part of the Medicaid program. And from the work that I've done for Medicaid, and this is kind of going off memory, so I could be misremembering, but my memory is that even though that is a kind of obvious, it's a visible portion of Medicaid services, it is not actually a huge portion of what we pay for. And Medicaid as a program is actually a very efficient and Medicaid beneficiaries get a lot of care, and because those prices are, determined, they're in some ways it's a very good program. I mean, I've often wondered, could people buy into Medicaid actually, and could we subsidize the Medicaid program somehow and gain access to those benefits? And again, that's kind of going back to the sort of underlying principle of the healthcare authority, which is Medicaid right now has 180,000 covered lives. And with expansion, we're covering people up to 138% of the poverty line, which is that's a working population. So we right now are providing healthcare to people who are employed and whose employers don't provide that care. So, you know, to me, there's, you know, it would be tricky because it's a very regulated program. But on the other hand, it's a very good program. And I think with more covered lives, it would be something that you could do some of the reforms that we're talking about. You could really incentivize primary care. You could integrate behavioral health. You could do all those things if that program had a little bit more leverage.
One thing I found interesting in my reporting was that the hospitals have to do these Medicaid cost reports where they analyze and audit exactly how much it costs them to do every procedure, and then Medicaid will just pay them that much plus a small profit, which seems so much more logical than the way most hospital procedures are priced for the rest of us. So there are some, there's something there that we could look at as a, as something good to model. All right, let's go to Jim, who's calling from Palmer. Jim?
Thank you very much, and I'm glad you're having this discussion. We've in the past, the state of Alaska has looked at ways of combining resources, and there's at least three commissions that studied it. That was before 1990 when I really got involved. But one of the things that they talked about was getting all public employees, like states and cities and municipalities and school districts, all into one plan, and then adding people into that. We have such a strange system because you have military care, you have VA care, you have tribal care, and all these things are split up. And so not only are we a small state, but it's really hard to get any critical mass. But those are some things that have been tried. I did an experiment way back then where we got a hold of the procedures that were published by the Canadian government for the Yukon Territory. And they listed all the procedures that they covered and what they would pay for them. And you can't even find out what your insurance company is going to pay, much less have a menu of what your physicians are going to pay. And if we just had mandatory cost disclosure, that might help. And I know that the Matsuburo has offers a bridge health as part of their health care plan, where they will take you outside into the, you know, outside in the lower 48 and find a highly qualified physician and pay for your travel costs and your hotel costs while you're there, because mm-hmm. it's cheaper than doing it here.
Yeah, I think a lot of the insurance companies are doing that now. The cost transparency thing is something that has received some attention, because we talk about, you know, competition and the free market, and the rest of our lives, we don't buy products without knowing the price. That's sort of an essential part of a market. And so we do have a cost transparency ordinance here in Anchorage, and I think a state cost transparency bill passed. Is that right, Cliff, or am I misremembering?
I don't know if it passed. It was certainly been considered. Yeah. I know it's passed in
Anchorage. Do you feel like cost transparency is a fundamental solution, or do you think it would help, or how do you see it?
It could be helpful, but one of the tricky parts is, what price are we talking about? One orthopedic surgeon said, well, it would be like a big book, Cliff, because there's so many different prices with so many different insurance plans. That goes back to what I talked about earlier on this program about the big difference in most other countries have more of a single price system. We have a very much of a multiple price system.
Right. But just to push back on that, I mean, if you go to a hotel, there'll be a rack rate, which is probably their highest price, and then there'll be a corporate rate and a AAA rate and all these different rates. But if you say to them, what's my rate, they will tell you, right? You could say, well, I'm not AAA, I'm not corporate, what do I have to pay if I buy a room right now? But if you go to the hospital, it's much harder to get that answer, right?
That's correct, and also partly because there's not the hotel, all the services are provided by the hotel. Part of the other issue is you have, like in an operation on a knee replacement, more than one provider, you know, each providing with a different fee.
So it'd be very complicated
more
as a shopper.
Thea?
I think that transparency is part of what I would think is more important, which is simplicity. And I think if we're talking about improving health and increasing the value for the amount we're paying, what we want is a simpler system. And I guess I want to speak kind of in support of the providers a little bit, because I feel like they're kind of getting they're getting, you know, some flack here today. And I guess what I want to say for those that I've worked with on this issue, what they want is to be able to serve their patients and do a good job. And their lives are made very difficult by the same level of complexity that plagues you as a patient. It plagues you like 1,000 times over as a provider. So they will often say there's so much time spent dealing with insurance companies, dealing with all of the complexity that we're talking about. And there's zero support in our system for that. There's no shared data. There's no shared billing system. There's nothing provided by anybody to make it easier. So I think simplifying is hugely important, but it's for the patient and for the provider.
Well, and some of these managed care organizations outside Alaska, like the Kaiser Permanente, and even I hear somewhat from here in Alaska, even though the doctors may make a little bit less money, they have a much higher quality of life and they enjoy it. So it could be beneficial for everyone.
Exactly.
Let's just keep moving. Let's go to Kathy calling from Anchorage. Kathy?
Oh, hello. Well, I've been on Medicare for about 7 years. Before that, I was on with State, with Aetna. And to tell you the truth, I find Medicare excellent. And yes, there was some difficulty getting primary care doctors. I used the clinic in South Anchorage before it closed. But what I have done in the stopgap is I go to nurse practitioners or physician's assistants. And I also have a Medicare. The Medicare I have allows me to go directly to a specialist. For example, if I have a urinary problem, I don't have to go to a primary care. I just call the urinary specialist that pays Medicare.
Right, and that was brought up in one of the forums that I attended, that actually the cardiac specialists are doing a lot of primary care because of the crazy way that Medicare is paying for it. They can actually get compensated.
Cliff? Correct, and there's also what the caller is talking about is sometimes called task shifting. And that maybe in our healthcare system, in our country, in our state, too many things that are done by highly trained physicians could instead be done by nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, or in some cases, nurses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Well, thanks, Kathy. Did you want to add anything to that, or did you get to say your piece?
Yes. Most specialists are hiring nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. And so I tell my friends, get your foot in the door. You'll see somebody. You'll get your work up. And if you need to see the next level, then you can see it. So they're actually they're doing that. They're providing this different level of care.
Yeah, it's kind of a workaround that's taken place. Yeah, Thea, did you want to add to that?
I just want to say that I'm glad that's working out for you, Kathy, but that to me is a symptom of how our system is not working, because essentially what's happening is because there's such a differential between how primary care is incentivized and compensated and specialist care. Specialists are now taking on that role when that isn't, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking them, but that isn't their training. You know, internal medicine, family medicine, pediatrics, those are specialties of themselves. And that's what, you know, is the sort of bedrock of primary care. And that's who should be providing that care.
Right. Thanks, Kathy. We need to keep going because we're out of time. Matt wrote in an email, which I think is kind of interesting. He says, if you knew what you had to pay, would patients be willing to go through with the procedures? That would surely drive down costs as people would not want a lot of the care they request. His point is, I think, on the cost transparency. But then if you're not paying that cost, and this was brought up in one of your previous forums of a patient who found out the cost, found out it would be much more to have it in Alaska, and then chose the highest cost because his insurance was capped and he wasn't going to pay any more than that. Let's in 30 seconds we have left, let's do a little bit of a summary. Is this your last forum, Cliff, of your healthcare?
This is the fifth and final forum in this series of events on Alaska's high healthcare costs. Tonight, Wednesday, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the 49th State Brewing Company on 3rd Avenue.
With a $10 donation requested.
Correct.
And both of you will be there?
That's right, on the stage.
And you'll be digging into these solution questions.
Absolutely.
And digging into them in even more depth than we did today.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you, Cliff Groh, for being here. He's the chair of Alaska Common Ground. And thanks to Thea Agnew-Benben for being here from Agnew-Beck Consultants.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be here.
All right. Well, thanks to you, listeners, for being on the show with us today. Next year and next week, Kathleen McCoy will be back as your host. Dave Waldron's our producer on Hometown Alaska. My name's Charles Walforth, and I will see you later.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.